Welcome to Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. Coming up on the programme this week:
the sad reality is about 2 in 5 male deaths occur before the age of 75. Many men underestimate their health needs and they avoid seeking vital care and resources, possibly until it's too late.
Are men dying currently unnecessarily early?
Some of them relate to risk factors around recklessness, for example, so drinking, smoking, driving too fast. But there'll be other ones as well that, you know, we have yet to uncover.
And I'll be reminding you how you can make connections with mental health organisations within your community. It's Mental Health Monday.
The home of the UK's conversation about mental health. Welcome to Mental Health Monday. A pleasure as ever to have you on board for this episode, and to thank you as well for your downloading of previous episodes, your streams as well. I've had some really positive feedback, of course, for the Jake Daniels conversation. And then before that, of course, we were talking about women, female gambling as an issue, which was another popular episode with lots of people sort of getting their head around that as an issue. I really appreciate your feedback on that. And also your comments that are coming through on social media and on email. Details of how you can contact me are always in the podcast notes. Always keen to hear from you. And if you've got topics or issues that you want to raise, then absolutely let's be hearing from you. I always like to hear a little bit of feedback about the programme. Right, we've drawn Movember to a close, and at the end of Movember it has been announced that there is going to be a new Men's Health Institute being set up by the Movember charity, and this is going to be a seriously multi-million pound investment across some of the major nations that operate around the Movember movement. That's going to pull together research, investment, best practice, and 1,001 other things when it comes to men's physical and, of course, mental health. Now, I remember when Movember was just about growing a tash and you could get the least feeble one. But of course, then it was about fundraising, and there was a big switch a number of years ago to really include mental health within that conversation. So, of course, talk about testicular cancer and prostate cancer, absolutely. But let's talk about mental health as part of that. And that's what Movember have really been driving, done a really strong job on it. And actually, that idea of parity of esteem is going to be at the forefront of what this new Men's Health Institute is going to be all about. So I've been speaking to, at the launch, Sarah Sternberg, who is Global Lead for Reimagining Masculinities, great title, at Movember. Sarah is a great guest and is right across so many of the issues that men are going through. And we talked about what this institute hopes to achieve, how it's going to achieve these things, and of course, how it's going to go about helping not just men live longer, with 2 in 5 men dying before the age of 75, true story, and men living 5 years less on average than women in the UK, another true story. How are they going to live longer and also healthier lives and happier lives? Not just for them, but of course for the people around them too. It's an important question. Sarah Sternberg is our guest on this week's Mental Health Monday. And it was a pleasure to speak to him about the launch and to hear all about how it's hopefully going to work.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, Mick. And yeah, we're really excited to be launching the Movember Men's Health Institute. Today, the vision for it is that we're going to be investing $100 million over the next 5 years to really kind of accelerate progress in research on men's health. It's going to have a kind of global remit, but have presence in each of our core Movember markets. And the ambition really is to support capacity building in research, so get more men's health researchers doing work and publishing work and sharing their findings, and then really accelerate some of the impact that we're able to have on the ground with men in their actual lives through research and evidence building.
$100 million sounds like a nice round figure. What does that look like in terms of what that gets spent on in the coming years?
So the actual agenda for the Institute is still kind of being worked through. We're going to continue to be investing in some of our core areas of prostate cancer, testicular cancer, and mental health, but we're also going to be taking a kind of much broader holistic men's health lens. So really trying to understand what are some of the root causes that that mean that men, you know, die on average in the UK 5 years earlier than women. What are some of the key drivers of men's poor health, and how can we think about research and programs that will help men to live happier, healthier and longer lives?
A lot of people sort of growing up were always aware there was always this sort of like differentiation between the length of time that women lived versus men. And I think I grew up at a time where it was because it came from a time that men did a lot of manual labor jobs. There was a sort of the physical impact of that versus the a woman's job, who which was deemed to be less physically significant, and therefore it was that they, that was the easy equation to sort of balance out. As we learn more in that space, are we starting to get a sense of other things that are at play potentially?
Yeah, we are. It's a I agree with you. It's really interesting, isn't it, how the narrative around kind of what is causing kind of premature deaths in men, and you know how that narrative changes over time. So we know that in the UK, the sad reality is about 2 in 5 male deaths occur before the age of 75. And the reason for this, you know, we think, but as ever, there's more work to do, is down to kind of inadequate health awareness and literacy. Many men underestimate their health needs and they avoid seeking vital care and resources, possibly until it's too late, or just avoid seeking support at all, whereas women are more, on the whole, more comfortable to seek support where they need it and kind of interact with community support, with the health system. So a big part of actually what we'll be doing in the Institute is around thinking about how can we really strengthen men's health literacy, get them to take action sooner on their health.
Are men dying currently unnecessarily early?
Yes. I mean, I would say them dying too young and for largely preventable reasons. And there's loads that we can learn from countries. You know, there are countries in the world where there are men's health strategies, for example. We don't have a men's health strategy in the UK, but it would be very interesting to think about what can we learn from some of these strategies, how they've been implemented, if they've been successful, and how can we look at what some of the kind of root causes are of some of these preventable illnesses. Some of them relate to risk factors around, you know, recklessness, for example. So drinking, smoking, driving too fast. But there'll be other ones as well that, that you know, we have yet to uncover.
Obviously, you're talking about men's health, and I think Movember have been really sort of championing in the last, particularly the last 5-6 years, this idea that physical and mental health has this phrase, parity of esteem. And that seems to be the focus with the work you do in the Institute. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. I think parity of esteem is a great way of thinking about it. And actually, I think for us, it's about recognizing the whole man and taking a really kind of holistic picture of what's going on for him in physical and mental health, but also kind of his social environment, the kind of support he might or might not have in the community. What are some of the kind of demographic factors that might be playing a role in his health? So for us, I think it's definitely taking that parity of esteem framework and thinking about how can we understand the full picture of a man's life.
What are the gaps, do you think? I mean, obviously research will be a big part of it and bringing together the research. What are those gaps for you? Are you thinking, oh, if we knew this or if we understood this, maybe some of these figures would make a little bit more sense?
I think for me, and I would say this because I'm the masculinities person at Movember, but for me, I think it's being able to draw a really clear thread between adherence to masculine norms, so ideas about what it means to be a man, and health outcomes. There's a range of evidence in different places, kind of different pockets in academia, different organizations, different partners, around the contribution that that adherence to specific gender norms makes on men's health. But I'd love to get to a place where we have like really kind of hardcore indubitable evidence on that front, because then I think we can start to think about what are some of the ways culturally that we can all play a part in kind of improving men's health by being, being more supportive to men in our communities.
In terms of awareness within the space, obviously there's a lot about education and awareness of, you know, well, would you know if you had a prostate issue? Like, and what would be those signs? I think particularly within the female space, I think if you've got a lump on your breast cancer, is there something you need to get? That seems to cut through a lot more in that space than anything I've ever heard on anything about testicular cancer, which is kind of like the, you know, if there's a lump, maybe that. But prostate cancer, it's if you the way your wee changes, like is that the thing? There's almost like there's the education around that, which is fine. But then you've also got this other thing, which is the stubbornness of men. We're like, and I don't know any other better phrase to put that in. And that's the same, I think, for mental health as well, that there's just a presumption or an assumption that life, you feel like this because that's how you feel, that you've, this is the bed and this is the bed in which you're lying in now. There are two things there, isn't there? There's empowering men to know the difference, and then there's also breaking that stigma around it too. Do you see those as two separate things potentially?
I think they are separate things, but they are, of course, kind of inextricably connected. So I think one of the things that I'm really interested in exploring is the extent to which some of norms around stoicism for men around, you know, I don't want to be a problem, I don't want to be a burden, you know, it's important for me to be a strong provider. How do those things stop men from seeking help, even if they do sense that something isn't normal? But I think there's also a reality, which is that most men don't necessarily have a strong sense of what is normal for them. And if something does start to tip into, it doesn't feel normal for me, that it's very difficult to then take the next step of seeking professional or, you know, more informal support. And I think there's a truth about the way in which men and women interact differently with formal healthcare. But men often aren't necessarily having any touch points with the formal healthcare system until something is significantly wrong and they feel like they can't ignore it anymore. And I think our perspective is that that's potentially a bit of a vicious cycle, that if you aren't having positive experiences with professionalized healthcare as a matter of course through your life, and you're not having, you know, regular check-ins with your GP, for example, it's much more likely to feel scary. So I think for us, it's sort of, it's both things. It's the knowing what's normal, it's being able to take action on your health, but it's also feeling, I think, confident that you will have a positive outcome as a result of seeking specialist support. And the reality is, if you go later, you're less likely to have a positive outcome. And so I think it's trying to sort of think about how can we break that cycle through increased awareness and education, but also working directly with the formal healthcare system to improve the way in which they're sort of thinking about the specific needs of men.
I was going to ask you about that. So from a point of view, if knowledge is power and, you know, the Institute gathers the knowledge, how do you turn that into results, if you like? What's the vision, if you like, for the Institute in terms of then turning that information into a connection that gets more men through the door of a GP?
I think there are a number of ways. So I think we'll be pouring some of the insight and kind of findings into our own programs that we run. We run lots of programs with community partners in the markets that we work in across the world. We'll also be sharing that information much more broadly with other charity partners in the sector, because, you know, that's, you know, part of the ambition is to sort of uplift the whole sector, not just our own work. But we'll also be thinking about how can we work directly with healthcare systems, clinicians. An example of one of our programs is called Men in Mind. And it's a program which supports clinicians in thinking about what are some of the ways in which my program, or, you know, my support service isn't serving men, and what are some of the tools and techniques that clinicians can learn that will enable them to both reach men to get them in the door, but then also keep them there. Because, for example, mental health services, we know, are much less likely to be visited by men. Men are less likely to stick with them than women. And they're also less likely to report they've had a positive experience. So that's a place where actually there could be a real opportunity to understand what are some of the ways in which mental health services aren't supporting men's needs, and then work directly with clinical services to improve the ways in which they're able to reach and engage men.
You think that by being Movember and, you know, grow a tash and raise some money, that actually you're creating a little bit of a disjoint between yourself and something like the NHS or the government? Do you feel like that will actually go in your favour, that men are more likely maybe to warm to something they're seen as part of Movember, almost to have permission to look or see what you're talking about, versus, you know, something that might come from a more, shall we say, formal source?
I think in terms of education and awareness, that's definitely been part of our approach. So our testicular cancer campaign is called Know Thy Nuts. It's got a very kind of humorous approach to thinking about understanding what's normal for you and getting to know your testicles rather than, you know, not having a sense. And that's obviously the kind of campaign that would never come from the NHS or the government, and like, nor should it. So I think there's a way in which Movember is able to engage with men on serious topics, but in quite a lighthearted way. I don't think it's a substitute for some of that and more, you know, some of that important health information that comes from a range of sources. But I think for us, our opportunity is also about being in culture, you know, chatting to people like you, being present in media and music and entertainment and other spaces where men are there to have a good time. They're not there to necessarily receive a health message. So being able to reach men where they are and in ways that are making some of this content feel a bit more lighthearted definitely feels like it's something Movember can bring to the table that other people can't.
it feeds into a wider conversation potentially. And I've mentioned this on the podcast before, so if anyone's hearing this, then forgive me, but we did a Football Untold series where we did a piece on gambling harm, and footballers shared their stories of problem gambling that they'd experienced. As a result of that, our partner, the Beacon Counselling Trust, saw a 200% increase in the number of men coming forward,
wow,
which for us was like an incredible result. And often people were saying, these are hard to reach men. They weren't hard to reach. You just had to find the right way to reach them. There's an element of that thing with this whole conversation that's, there are some preconceptions, I think, that men don't want to be part of this conversation or can't be reasoned with or helped or supported because they'll reject it outright. There's something to be said, though, isn't there, for maybe just thinking about a little bit smarter about how we can make that connection.
I think that's exactly right. And I think one of the things that we try and bang the drum for a lot at Movember is about leaving assumptions at the door about, you know, what would work or wouldn't work for a man. We do a huge amount of research already that is around how we can best engage with men and tackle sensitive issues. And actually, one of the things that we find time and time again is that if you give men a safe space to talk about some of these things, they're desperate to talk about them because they don't necessarily have some of those avenues or forums in their own lives. But that doesn't mean that they're not interested in engaging. It just means maybe that the environment isn't enabling some of those conversations.
The headline figure, and I've quoted this so many times, about 3/4 of suicide are male, is obviously a huge factor. And there's a lot to that conversation, but ultimately it's the ultimate price that we're paying for the stigma around mental health and not tackling the issue that men are taking their own lives. In some cases, it's the most prominent, you know, reason for death in certain age groups as well. If we bring it down to half, then it's still too high, and then it represents then that women are also taking that. But there's got to be a target around that, hasn't there? There's got to be something that we can focus on as a mental health community, if you like.
Absolutely.
Towards bringing that number down. And that it's a stubborn 3 out of 4 as well. That number's not really changing at any point. What for you would be a goal or aim around that stat in particular?
I mean, that stat is always so shocking. It doesn't really matter, I think, how many times you hear it. And I think, you know, for everyone who has direct experience with suicide, it feels very striking to think about the prevalence. I think at Movember, our focus is really around kind of preventative health. So thinking about, I always think about it a little bit like, it's a glib metaphor, but is it putting a plug in or is it turning the tap off, or like trying to stop a tap from leaking? And I think we're very much in the try and stop the tap from leaking, try and stop the wave of young men who, you know, might be feeling really down, might be feeling really lost, really hopeless. What are the ways in which they can be better supported? And I think that is a really difficult question, because the diversity of issues facing men, the diversity of men themselves, mean that it's going to be a very wide range of problems, and also a very wide range of solutions that might be suitable or not suitable for individual young men. But that's where I think for us, it's about doing the research, building the evidence base around what does and doesn't work, you know, whether that's community programs, whether that's formal healthcare services, whether that's campaigns, and thinking really critically about, you know, what evidence do we have in terms of what drives positive outcomes, and therefore, what can we scale? What can we amplify? How can we work in partnership with other organizations? Because it is, as you say, a really stubborn statistic where, you know, there are other organizations who are much better placed to be thinking about, you know, putting the plug in. So for us, it's about thinking about how can we really champion a really smart, integrated, preventative agenda around men's mental health.
If we speak as well now to people who've been raising money for Movember, who've, you know, grown a Mo, maybe do it every single year, that sort of the money that they raise, a lot of it will have come in your direction in terms of Movember, and obviously there's the investment in this service now. So what do you say to people about what you will do or what your aims are to sort of garnish that support that you've got and the sort of the goodwill that there is to Movember, and then turn it into this physical and sort of like a metaphorical space where real change can come from?
I think it's sort of, you know, I think there's something so exciting about this announcement, because this is, you know, the first of its kind. A global mental health institute, you know, doesn't exist. So we're so excited to be launching it, because it feels like the more focus, the more sunlight, you know, we can get on some of these issues, the much greater the likelihood is going to be of actually finding ways to tackle them. And we're not going to stop any of our existing work in communities, all the kind of successful programs that we currently run ourselves or with partners, and the kind of ongoing research agenda that we've been part of for the last 20 years around prostate cancer, testicular cancer, and mental health. In a way, this is about creating a metaphorical house for that work and bringing the spotlight to men's health in a way that hasn't existed before, but then should hopefully galvanize many more people who want to do research in this field, partners who are seeking support and kind of connections and networks to their own work. It's a way of really, I think, strengthening the field so that in 10 years' time, we can really see how has the men's health agenda moved. And I think that's the thing. It's the time frame on it is a long one, because as we know, research takes time. You want to get it right. You don't want to invest in the wrong things. But I think that's the prize really for everybody who's running or growing a TASH or hosting a party or doing kind of all the amazing things that people do to support us in the month, is to say, you know, we will all be able to look back in several years' time and say, wow, the men's health picture has completely changed. And part of that is because we have been able to shed a spotlight on the importance of men's health, accelerate research, and build the evidence for what works through this institute.
So we wish you all the best with it. Look forward to seeing some of the work you're kicking off with as well, and over the coming months and then years as well. Sarah, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Thanks for checking out Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Mick Coyle. You can also find me, Mick Coyle, on Facebook as well. Don't forget, if you want to speak to somebody about your mental health, you can do so. The Samaritans, free to call on 116 123. You can find mental health services where you are. Just look for the Hub of Hope. Type in your postcode. It'll find those mental health services close to you. And for support in a crisis, you can text SHOUT to 85258. That's if you're experiencing a personal crisis, you're unable to cope and need support. Shout to 85258. That's a text line. Do get involved in those services. In an absolute emergency, always remember the number to call is 999. Thanks for downloading the podcast this week. We'll be back next week with more Mental Health Monday.